she said after a moment. I guess you are.
You told me, he said, in the graveyard.
It seems like such a long time ago, puppy, she said. Then she said, I feel better here. It doesn't hurt as much, you know what I mean? But I'm so dry.
The wind let up, and he could smell her now, a stink of rotten meat and sickness and decay, pervasive and unpleasant.
I lost my job, she said. It was a night job, but they said people had complained. I told them I was sick, and they said they didn't care. I'm so thirsty.
The women, he told her, they have water. The house.
Puppy? She sounded scared.
Tell them I said to give you water.
The white face stared up at him. I should go, she told him. Then she hacked and made a face and spat a mass of something white onto the grass. It broke up when it hit the ground and wriggled away. It was almost impossible to breathe. His chest felt heavy, and his head was swaying.
Stay,
he said, in a breath that was almost a whisper, unsure whether or not she could hear him.
Please don't go.
He started to cough.
Stay the night.
I'll stop a while, she said. And then, like a mother to a child, she said, Nothing's gonna hurt you when I'm here. You know that. Shadow coughed once more. He closed his eyes, only for a moment, he thought, but when he opened them again, the moon had set, and he was alone. A crashing and a pounding in his head, beyond the pain of migraine, beyond all pain. Everything dissolved into tiny butterflies, which circled him like a multicolored dust storm and then evaporated into the night. The white sheet wrapped about the body at the base of the tree flapped noisily in the morning wind. The pounding eased. Everything slowed. There was nothing left to make him keep breathing. His heart ceased to beat in his chest. The darkness that he entered this time was deep and lit by a single star, and it was final.
Chapter 16. I know it's crooked, but it's the only game in town. Canada Bill Jones.
The tree was gone, and the world was gone, and the morning gray sky above him was gone. The sky was now the color of midnight. There was a single cold star shining high above him, a blazing, twinkling light, and nothing else. He took a single step and almost tripped. Shadow looked down. There were steps cut into the rock going down, steps so huge that he could only imagine that giants had cut them and descended them a long time ago. He clambered downward, half jumping, half vaulting from step to step. His body ached, but it was the ache of lack of use, not the tortured ache of a body that has hung on a tree until it was dead. He observed, without surprise, that he was now fully dressed, in jeans and a white T-shirt. He was barefoot. He experienced a profound moment of déjà vu. This was what he had been wearing when he stood in Chernobog's apartment the night when Zorya Polunochnaya had come to him and told him about the constellation called Odin's Wain. She had taken the moon down from the sky for him. He knew, suddenly, what would happen next. Zorya Polunochnaya would be there. She was waiting for him at the bottom of the steps. There was no moon in the sky, but she was bathed in moonlight nonetheless. Her white hair was moon pale, and she wore the same lace and linen nightdress she had worn that night in Chicago. She smiled when she saw him, and looked down as if momentarily embarrassed. "Hello," she said.
"Aye," said Shadow.
"How are you?"
"I don't know," he said. "I think this is maybe another strange dream on the tree. I've been having crazy dreams since I got out of prison." Her face was silvered by the moonlight, but no moon hung in that plum-black sky, and now, at the foot of the steps, even the single star was lost to view. And she looked both solemn and vulnerable. She said,
"All your questions can be answered, if that is what you want.
But once you learn your answers, you can never unlearn them." Beyond her, the path forked. He would have to decide which path to take, he knew that, but there was one thing he had to do first. He reached into the pocket of his jeans and was relieved when he felt the familiar weight of the coin at the bottom of the pocket. He eased it out, held it between finger and thumb, a 1922 Liberty dollar. "This is yours," he said. He remembered then that his clothes were really at the foot of the tree. The women had placed his clothes in the canvas sack from which they had taken the ropes and tied the end of the sack, and the biggest of the women had placed a heavy rock on it to stop it from blowing away. And so he knew that, in reality, the Liberty dollar was in a pocket in that sack beneath the rock. But still it was heavy in his hand at the entrance to the underworld. She took it from his palm with her slim fingers.
"Thank you. It bought you your liberty twice," she said. "And now it will light your way into dark places."
She closed her hand around the dollar. Then she reached up and placed it in the air as high as she could reach. Then she let go of it. Instead of falling, the coin floated upward until it was a foot or so above Shadow's head. It was no longer a silver coin, though. Lady Liberty and her crown of spikes were gone. The face he saw on the coin was the indeterminate face of the moon in the summer sky. Shadow couldn't decide whether he was looking at a moon the size of a dollar a foot above his head, or whether he was looking at a moon the size of the Pacific Ocean many thousands of miles away, nor whether there was any difference between the two ideas. Perhaps it was all a matter of the way you looked at it. He looked at the forking path ahead of him. "Which path should I take?" he asked. "Which one is safe?"
"Take one and you cannot take the other," she said. "But neither path is safe. Which way would you walk, the way of hard truths or the way of fine lies?"
"Truths," he said. "I've come too far for more lies." She looked sad.
"There will be a price, then," she said.
"I'll pay it. What's the price?"
"Your name," she said. "Your real name. You will have to give it to me."
"How?"
"Like this," she said.
She reached a perfect hand toward his head. He felt her fingers brush his skin, then he felt them penetrate his skin, his skull, felt them push deep into his head. Something tickled in his skull and all down his spine. She pulled her hand out of his head, a flame, like a candle flame, but burning with a clear magnesium-white luminance, was flickering on the tip of her forefinger.
"Is that my name?" he asked.
She closed her hand, and the light was gone.
"It was," she said.
She extended her hand and pointed to the right-hand path.
"That way," she said. "For now."
Nameless, Shadow walked down the right-hand path in the moonlight. When he turned around to thank her, he saw nothing but darkness. It seemed to him that he was deep under the ground, but when he looked up into the darkness above him, he still saw the tiny moon. He turned a corner. If this was the afterlife, he thought, it was a lot like the house on the rock, part diorama, part nightmare. He was looking at himself in prison blues, in the warden's office, as the warden told him that Laura had died in a car crash. He saw the expression on his own face. He looked like a man who had been abandoned by the world. It hurt him to see it, the nakedness and the fear.
He hurried on, pushed through the warden's gray office, and found himself looking at the VCR repair store on the outskirts of Eagle Point 3 years ago. Yes. Inside the store, he knew. He was beating the living crap out of Larry Powers and B.J. West, bruising his knuckles in the process. Pretty soon he would walk out of there, carrying a brown supermarket bag filled with $20 bills. The money they could never prove he had taken. His share of the proceeds, and a little more, for they shouldn't have tried to rip him and Laura off like that. He was only the driver, but he had done his part, done everything that she had asked of him. At the trial, nobody mentioned the bank robbery, although everybody wanted to. They couldn't prove a thing as long as nobody was talking. And nobody was. The prosecutor was forced instead to stick to the bodily damage that Shadow had inflicted on Powers and West. He showed photographs of the two men on their arrival in the local hospital. Shadow barely defended himself in court. It was easier that way. Neither Powers nor West seemed able to remember what the fight had been about, but they each admitted that Shadow had been their assailant. Nobody talked about the money. Nobody even mentioned Laura. And that was all that Shadow had wanted. Shadow wondered whether the path of comforting lies would have been a better one to walk. He walked away from that place and followed the rock path down into what looked like a hospital room, a public hospital in Chicago, and he felt the bile rise in his throat. He stopped. He didn't want to look. He didn't want to keep walking. In the hospital bed, his mother was dying again, as she died when he was 16, and yes, here he was, a large, clumsy 16-year-old with acne pocking his cream and coffee skin, sitting at her bedside, unable to look at her, reading a thick paperback book. Shadow wondered what the book was, and he walked around the hospital bed to inspect it more closely. He stood between the bed and the chair, looking from the one to the other, the big boy hunched into his chair, his nose buried in gravity's rainbow, trying to escape from his mother's death into London during the Blitz, the fictional madness of the book, no escape and no excuse. His mother's eyes were closed in a morphine peace. What she had thought was just another sickle cell crisis, another bout of pain to be endured, had turned out, they had discovered, too late, to be lymphoma. There was a lemonish gray tinge to her skin. She was in her early 30s. But she looked much older. Shadow wanted to shake himself, the awkward boy that he once was, get him to hold her hand, talk to her, do something before she slipped away, as he knew that she would. But he could not touch himself, and he continued to read. And so his mother died, while he sat in the chair next to her, reading a fat book. After that he had more or less stopped reading. You couldn't trust fiction. What good were books if they couldn't protect you from something like that? Shadow walked away from the hospital room, down the winding corridor, deep into the bowels of the earth. He sees his mother first, and he cannot believe how young she is. Not yet 25, he guesses, before her medical discharge. They're in their apartment, another embassy rental somewhere in northern Europe. He looks around for something to give him a clue, and he sees himself, a shrimp of a kid. Big, pale, gray eyes, dark hair, and skin that's neither one thing nor another. They are arguing. Shadow knows, without hearing the words, what they're arguing about. It was the only thing they quarreled about, after all. "Tell me about my father." "He's dead. Don't ask about him." "But who was he?" "Forget him. Dead and gone, and you ain't missed nothing." "I want to see a picture of him." "I ain't got a picture," she'd say. And her voice would get quiet and fierce, and he knew that if he kept asking her questions, she would shout or even hit him. And he knew that he wouldn't stop asking questions, so he turned away and walked on down the tunnel. The path he followed twisted and wound and curled back on itself, and it put him in mind of snake skins and intestines and of deep, deep tree roots. There was a pool to his left. He heard the drip, drip of water into it somewhere at the back of the tunnel, the falling water barely ruffling the mirrored surface of the pool. He dropped to his knees and drank, using his hand to bring the water to his lips. Then he walked on until he was standing in the floating, disco-glitter patterns of a mirror ball. It was like being in the exact center of the universe, with all the stars and planets circling him, and he couldn't hear anything, not the music, nor the shouted conversations over the music, and now Shadow was staring at a woman who looked just like his mother never looked in all the years he knew her. She's little more than a child, after all. And she's dancing. Shadow found that he was completely unsurprised when he recognized the man who dances with her. He had not changed that much in 33 years. She's drunk. Shadow could see that at a glance. She's not very drunk, but she is unused to drink, and in a week or so she will take a ship to Norway. They've been drinking margaritas, and she has salt on her lips and salt clinging to the back of her hand. Wednesday isn't wearing a suit and tie, but the pin in the shape of a silver tree he wears over the pocket of his shirt glitters and glints when the mirror ball light catches it. They make a fine-looking couple, considering the difference in their ages. There is a lupine grace to Wednesday's movements. A slow dance. He pulls her close to him, and his paw-like hand curves around the seat of her skirt possessively, moving her closer to him. His other hand takes her chin, pushes it upward into his face, and the two of them kiss, there, on the floor, as the glitter ball lights circle them into the center of the universe. Soon after they leave, she sways against him, and he leads her from the dance hall. Shadow buries his head in his hands and does not follow them, unable or unwilling to witness his own conception. The mirror lights were gone, and now the only illumination came from the tiny moon that burned high above his head. He walked on. At a bend in the path, he stopped for a moment to catch his breath. He felt a hand run gently up his back, and gentle fingers ruffled the hair on the back of his head. "Hello," whispered a smoky feline voice over his shoulder. "Hello," he said, turning to face her. She had brown hair and brown skin, and her eyes were the deep golden amber of good honey. Her pupils were vertical slits. "Do I know you?" he asked, puzzled. "Intimately," she said, and she smiled. "I used to sleep on your bed, and my people have been keeping their eyes on you for me." She turned to the path ahead of him, pointed to the three ways he could go. "Okay," she said, "one way will make you wise, one way will make you whole, and one way will kill you." "I'm already dead, I think," said Shadow. "I died on the tree." She made a moo. "There's dead," she said, "and there's dead, and there's dead. It's a relative thing." Then she smiled again. "I could make a joke about that, you know. Something about dead relatives."
"No," said Shadow. "It's okay."
"So," she said, "which way do you want to go?"
"I don't know," he admitted.
She tipped her head on one side, a perfectly feline gesture. Suddenly, Shadow remembered the claw marks on his shoulder. He felt himself beginning to blush. "If you trust me," said Bast, "I can choose for you."
"I trust you," he said, without hesitation.
"Do you want to know what it's going to cost you?"
"I've already lost my name," he told her.
"Names come and names go. Was it worth it?"
"Yes, maybe. It wasn't easy. As revelations go, it was kind of personal."
"All revelations are personal," she said. "That's why all revelations are suspect."
I don't understand.
No, she said, you don't. I'll take your heart. We'll need it later. And she reached her hand deep inside his chest, and she pulled it out with something ruby and pulsing held between her sharp fingernails. It was the color of pigeon's blood, and was made of pure light. Rhythmically, it expanded and contracted. She closed her hand, and it was gone. "Take the middle way," she said. Shadow nodded and walked on. The path was becoming slippery now. There was ice on the rock. The moon above him glittered through the ice crystals in the air. There was a ring about the moon, a moon bow diffusing the light. It was beautiful, but it made walking harder. The path was unreliable. He reached the place where the path divided. He looked at the first path with a feeling of recognition. It opened into a vast chamber, or a set of chambers, like a dark museum. He knew it already. He could hear the long echoes of tiny noises. He could hear the noise that the dust makes as it settles. It was the place that he had dreamed of that first night that Laura had come to him, in the motel so long ago. The endless memorial hall to the gods that were forgotten, and the ones whose very existence had been lost. He took a step backward. He walked to the path on the far side and looked ahead. There was a Disneyland quality to the corridor, black plexiglass walls with lights set in them. The colored lights blinked and flashed in the illusion of order for no particular reason, like the console lights on a television starship. He could hear something there as well, a deep, vibrating bass drone, which Shadow could feel in the pit of his stomach. He stopped and looked around. Neither way seemed right. Not any longer. He was done with paths. The middle way, the way the Catwoman had told him to walk, that was his way. He moved toward it. The moon above him was beginning to fade. The edge of it was pinking and going into eclipse. The path was framed by a huge doorway. Shadow walked through the arch in darkness. The air was warm, and it smelled of wet dust, like a city street after the summer's first rain. He wasn't afraid. Not anymore. Fear had died on the tree, as Shadow had died. There was no fear left, no hatred, no pain. Nothing left but essence. Something big splashed quietly in the distance, and the splash echoed into the vastness. He squinted but could see nothing. It was too dark. And then, from the direction of the splashes, a ghost light glimmered and the world took form. He was in a cavern. And in front of him, mirror smooth, was water. The splashing noises came closer, and the light became brighter, and Shadow waited on the shore. Soon enough, a low, flat boat came into sight, a flickering white lantern burning at its raised prow, another reflected in the glassy black water several feet below it. The boat was being poled by a tall figure, and the splashing noise Shadow had heard was the sound of the pole being lifted and moved as it pushed the craft across the waters of the underground lake. "Hello there," called Shadow. Echoes of his words suddenly surrounded him. He could imagine that a whole chorus of people were welcoming him and calling to him, and each of them had his voice. The person poling the boat made no reply. The boat's pilot was tall and very thin. He, if it was a he, wore an unadorned white robe, and the pale head that topped it was so utterly inhuman that Shadow was certain that it had to be a mask of some sort. It was a bird's head, small on a long neck, its beak long and high. Shadow was certain he had seen it before, this ghostly, bird-like figure. He grasped at the memory and then, disappointed, realized that he was picturing the clockwork penny in the slot machine in the house on the rock. And the pale, bird-like, half-glimpsed figure that glided out from behind the crypt for the drunkard's soul. Water dripped and echoed from the pole and the prow, and the ship's wake rippled the glassy waters. The boat was made of reeds, bound and tied.
The boat came close to the shore. The pilot leaned on its pole. Its head turned slowly until it was facing Shadow.
"Hello," it said, without moving its long beak.
The voice was male and, like everything else in Shadow's afterlife so far, familiar.
"Come on board. You'll get your feet wet, I'm afraid, but there's not a thing can be done about that. These are old boats, and if I come in closer, I could rip out the bottom."
Shadow took off his shoes and stepped out into the water. It came halfway up his calves, and was, after the initial shock of wetness, surprisingly warm. He reached the boat, and the pilot put down a hand and pulled him aboard. The reed boat rocked a little, and water splashed over the low sides of it, and then it steadied. The pilot pulled off away from the shore. Shadow stood there and watched, his pants legs dripping. "I know you," he said to the creature at the prow.
"You do indeed," said the boatman.
The oil lamp, which hung at the front of the boat, burned more fitfully, and the smoke from the lamp made Shadow cough.
"You worked for me. I'm afraid we had to inter Lila Goodchild without you."
The voice was fussy and precise. The smoke stung Shadow's eyes. He wiped the tears away with his hand, and through the smoke he thought he saw a tall man in a suit with gold-rimmed spectacles. The smoke cleared, and the boatman was once more a half-human creature with the head of a river bird.
"Mr. Ibis?"
"Good to see you, Shadow," said the creature, with Mr. Ibis's voice. "Do you know what a psychopomp is?"
Shadow thought he knew the word, but it had been a long time. He shook his head.
"It's a fancy term for an escort," said Mr. Ibis. "We all have so many functions, so many ways of existing. In my own vision of myself, I am a scholar who lives quietly and pens his little tales and dreams about a past that may or may not ever have existed. And that is true as far as it goes. But I am also, in one of my capacities, like so many of the people you have chosen to associate with, a psychopomp. I escort the living to the world of the dead."
"I thought this was the world of the dead," said Shadow.
"No, not per se. It's more of a preliminary."
The boat slipped and slid across the mirror surface of the underground pool. And then Mr. Ibis said, without moving its beak,
"You people talk about the living and the dead as if they were two mutually exclusive categories, as if you cannot have a river that is also a road, or a song that is also a color."
"You can't," said Shadow. "Can you?"
The echoes whispered his words back at him from across the pool.
"What you have to remember," said Mr. Ibis testily, "is that life and death are different sides of the same coin, like the heads and tails of a quarter."
"And if I had a double-headed quarter?"
"You don't."
Shadow had a frisson then, as they crossed the dark water. He imagined he could see the faces of children staring up at him reproachfully from beneath the water's glassy surface. Their faces were waterlogged and softened, their blind eyes clouded. There was no wind in that underground cavern to disturb the black surface of the lake.
"So I'm dead," said Shadow.
He was getting used to the idea.
"Or I'm going to be dead."
"We are on our way to the Hall of the Dead. I requested that I be the one to come for you."
"Why?"
"You were a hard worker. Why not?"
"Because..."
Shadow marshaled his thoughts. "Because I never believed in you. Because I don't know much about Egyptian mythology. Because I didn't expect this. What happened to St. Peter and the pearly gates?"
The long-beaked white head shook from side to side gravely. "It doesn't matter that you didn't believe in us," said Mr. Ibis. "We believed in you."
The boat touched bottom. Mr. Ibis stepped off the side into the pool and told Shadow to do the same. Mr. Ibis took a line from the prow of the boat and passed Shadow the lantern to carry. It was in the shape of a crescent moon. They walked ashore, and Mr. Ibis tied the boat to a metal ring set in the rock floor. Then he took the lamp from Shadow and walked swiftly forward, holding the lamp high as he walked, throwing vast shadows across the rock floor and the high rock walls.
"Are you scared?" asked Mr. Ibis.
"Not really."
"Well, try to cultivate the emotions of true awe and spiritual terror as we walk. They are the appropriate feelings for the situation at hand."
Shadow was not scared. He was interested and apprehensive, but no more. He wasn't scared of the shifting darkness, nor of being dead, nor even of the dog-headed creature the size of a grain silo who stared at them as they approached. It growled deep in its throat, and Shadow felt his neck hairs prickle.
"Shadow," it said, "now is the time of judgment."
Shadow looked up at the creature.
"Mr. Jaquel?" he said.
The hands of Anubis came down, huge dark hands, and they picked Shadow up and brought him close. The jackal head examined him with bright and glittering eyes, examined him as dispassionately as Mr. Jaquel had examined the dead girl on the slab. Shadow knew that all his faults, all his failings, all his weaknesses were being taken out and weighed and measured, that he was, in some way, being dissected and sliced and tasted. We do not always remember the things that do no credit to us. We justify them, cover them in bright lies or with the thick dust of forgetfulness. All of the things that Shadow had done in his life of which he was not proud, all the things he wished he had done otherwise or left undone, came at him then in a swirling storm of guilt and regret and shame, and he had nowhere to hide from them. He was as naked and as open as a corpse on a table, and dark Anubis, the jackal god, was his prosector and his prosecutor and his persecutor.
"Please," said Shadow, "please stop."
But the examination did not stop. Every lie he had ever told, every object he had stolen, every hurt he had inflicted on another person, all the little crimes and the tiny murders that make up the day, each of these things and more, were extracted and held up to the light by the jackal-headed judge of the dead. Shadow began to weep, painfully, in the palm of the dark god's hand. He was a tiny child again, as helpless and as powerless as he had ever been. And then, without warning, it was over. Shadow panted and sobbed, and snot streamed from his nose. He still felt helpless, but the hands placed him carefully, almost tenderly, down on the rock floor.
"Who has his heart?"
growled Anubis.
"I do," purred a woman's voice.
Shadow looked up. Bast was standing there beside the thing that was no longer Mr. Ibis, and she held Shadow's heart in her right hand. It lit her face with a ruby light.
"Give it to me," said Thoth, the Ibis-headed god,
and he took the heart in his hands, which were not human hands, and he glided forward. Anubis placed a pair of golden scales in front of him.
"So this is where we find out what I get?" whispered Shadow to Bast. "Heaven, hell, purgatory?"
"If the feather balances," she said, "you get to choose your own destination."
"And if not?" She shrugged, as if the subject made her uncomfortable. Then she said,
"Then we feed your heart and your soul to Ammit, the eater of souls."
"Maybe," he said, "maybe I can get some kind of a happy ending."
"Not only are there no happy endings," she told him, "there aren't even any endings."
On one of the pans of the scales, carefully, reverently, Anubis placed a feather. Anubis put Shadow's heart on the other pan of the scales. Something moved in the shadows under the scale, something that made Shadow uncomfortable to examine too closely. It was a heavy feather, but Shadow had a heavy heart, and the scales tipped and swung worryingly. But they balanced in the end, and the creature in the shadows skulked away, unsatisfied.
"So that's that," said Bast, wistfully. "Just another skull for the pile. It's a pity. I had hoped that you would do some good in the current troubles. It's like watching a slow-motion car crash and being powerless to prevent it."
"You won't be there?"
She shook her head. "I don't like other people picking my battles for me," she said.
There was silence then, in the vast hall of death, where it echoed of water in the dark. Shadow said, "So now I get to choose where I go next?"
"Choose," said Thoth, "or we can choose for you."
"No," said Shadow, "it's okay, it's my choice."
"Well," roared Anubis.
"I want to rest now," said Shadow. "That's what I want. I want nothing. No heaven, no hell. No anything. Just let it end."
"You're certain?" asked Thoth.
"Yes," said Shadow.
Mr. Jaquel opened the last door for Shadow, and behind that door there was nothing. Not darkness, not even oblivion. Only nothing. Shadow accepted it, completely and without reservation. And he walked through the door, into nothing, with a strange, fierce joy.
Chapter 17. Everything is upon a great scale upon this continent. The rivers are immense, the climate violent in heat and cold, the prospects magnificent, the thunder and lightning tremendous. The disorders incident to the country make every constitution tremble. Our own blunders here, our misconduct, our losses, our disgraces, our ruin, are on a great scale. Lord Carlyle to George Selwyn, 1778. The most important place in the southeastern United States is advertised on hundreds of aging barn roofs across Georgia and Tennessee and up into Kentucky. On a winding road through a forest, a driver will pass a rotting red barn and see, painted on its roof, "See Rock City, the eighth wonder of the world." And on the roof of a tumble-down milking shed nearby, painted in white block letters, "See seven states from Rock City, the world's wonder." The driver is led by this to believe that Rock City is surely just around the nearest corner, instead of being a day's drive away on Lookout Mountain, a hair over the state line in Georgia, just southwest of Chattanooga, Tennessee. Lookout Mountain is not much of a mountain. It resembles an impossibly high and commanding hill. The Chickamauga, a branch of the Cherokee, lived there when the white men came. They called the mountain Chattatanooga, which has been translated as the mountain that rises to a point. In the 1830s, Andrew Jackson's Indian Relocation Act exiled them from their land, all the Choctaw and Chickamauga and Cherokee and Chickasaw, and U.S. troops forced every one of them they could catch to walk over 1,000 miles to the new Indian territories in what would one day be Oklahoma, down the Trail of Tears, an act of casual genocide. Thousands of men, women, and children died on the way. When you've won, you've won, and nobody can argue with that. For whoever controlled Lookout Mountain controlled the land. That was the legend. It was a sacred site, after all, and it was a high place. In the Civil War, the war between the states, there was a battle there, the battle above the clouds. That was the first day's fighting, and then the Union forces did the impossible, and without orders, swept up Missionary Ridge and took it. The North took Lookout Mountain, and the North took the war. There are tunnels and caves, some very old, beneath Lookout Mountain. For the most part, they are blocked off now, although a local businessman excavated an underground waterfall which he called Ruby Falls. It can be reached by elevator. It's a tourist attraction, although the biggest tourist attraction of all is at the top of Lookout Mountain. That is Rock City. Rock City begins as an ornamental garden on a mountainside. Its visitors walk a path that takes them through rocks, over rocks, between rocks. They throw corn into a deer enclosure, cross a hanging bridge, and peer out through a quarter-a-throw binoculars at a view that promises them seven states on the rare sunny days when the air is perfectly clear. And from there, like a drop into some strange hell, the path takes the visitors, millions upon millions of them every year, down into caverns, where they stare at black-lit dolls arranged into nursery rhyme and fairy tale dioramas. When they leave bemused, uncertain of why they came, of what they have seen, of whether they had a good time or not. They came to Lookout Mountain from all across the United States. They were not tourists. They came by car, and they came by plane, and by bus, and by railroad, and on foot. Some of them flew. They flew low, and they flew only in the dark of the night. Several of them traveled their own ways beneath the earth. Many of them hitchhiked, cadging rides from nervous motorists or from truck drivers. Those who had cars or trucks would see the ones who had not walking beside the roads or at rest stations and in diners on the way, and, recognizing them for what they were, would offer them rides. They arrived dust-stained and weary at the foot of Lookout Mountain. Looking up to the heights of the tree-covered slope, they could see, or imagine that they could see, the paths and gardens and waterfall of Rock City. They started arriving early in the morning. A second wave of them arrived at dusk. And for several days, they simply kept coming. A battered U-Haul truck pulled up, disgorging several travel-weary Vila and Rusalka, their makeup smudged, runs in their stockings, their expressions heavy-lidded and tired. In a clump of trees at the bottom of the hill, an elderly vampire offered a Marlboro to a naked ape-like creature covered with a tangle of orange fur. It accepted graciously, and they smoked in silence, side by side. A Toyota Previa pulled over by the side of the road, and seven Chinese men and women got out of it. They looked, above all, clean, and they wore the kind of dark suits that in some countries are worn by minor government officials. One of them carried a clipboard, and he checked the inventory as they unloaded large golf bags from the back of the car. The bags contained ornate swords with lacquer handles and carved sticks and mirrors. The weapons were distributed, checked off, signed for. A once famous comedian, believed to have died in the 1920s, climbed out of his rusting car and proceeded to remove his clothing. His legs were goat legs, and his tail was short and goatish. Four Mexicans arrived, all smiles, their hair black and very shiny. They passed among themselves a bottle which they kept out of sight in a brown paper bag, its contents a bitter mixture of powdered chocolate, liquor, and blood. A small, dark-bearded man with a dusty black derby on his head, curling payas at his temples, and a ragged fringed prayer shawl came to them walking across the fields. He was several feet in front of his companion, who was twice his height and was the blank gray color of good Polish clay. The word inscribed on his forehead meant life. They kept coming. A cab drew up, and several Rakshasas, the demons of the Indian subcontinent, climbed out and milled around, staring at the people at the bottom of the hill without speaking, until they found Mamaji, her eyes closed, her lips moving in prayer. She was the only thing here that was familiar to them, but still they hesitated to approach her, remembering old battles. Her hands rubbed the necklace of skulls about her neck. Her brown skin became slowly black, the glassy black of jet, of obsidian. Her lips curled, and her long white teeth were very sharp. She opened all her eyes, beckoned the Rakshasas to her, and greeted them as she would have greeted her own children. The storms of the last few days, to the north and the east, had done nothing to ease the feeling of pressure and discomfort in the air. Local weather forecasters had begun to warn of cells that might spawn tornadoes, of high-pressure areas that did not move. It was warm by day there, but the nights were cold. They clumped together in informal companies, banding together sometimes by nationality, by race, by temperament, even by species. They looked apprehensive. They looked tired. Some of them were talking. There was laughter on occasion, but it was muted and sporadic. Six packs of beer were handed around. Several local men and women came walking over the meadows, their bodies moving in unfamiliar ways. Their voices, when they spoke, were the voices of the Lwa who rode them. A tall black man spoke in the voice of Papalegba who opens the gates. While Baron Samedi, the Vodun Lord of Death, had taken over the body of a teenage goth girl from Chattanooga, possibly because she possessed her own black silk top hat, which sat on her dark hair at a jaunty angle. She spoke in the Baron's own deep voice, smoked a cigar of enormous size, and commanded three of the Jede, the Lwa of the Dead. The Jede inhabited the bodies of three middle-aged brothers. They carried shotguns and told jokes of such outstanding filthiness that only they were willing to laugh at them, which they did, raucously. Two ageless Chickamauga women, in oil-stained blue jeans and battered leather jackets, walked around, watching the people and the preparations for battle. Sometimes they pointed and shook their heads. They did not intend to take part in the coming conflict. The moon swelled and rose in the east, a day away from full. It seemed half as big as the sky as it rose, a deep reddish orange, immediately above the hills. As it crossed the sky, it seemed to shrink and pale until it hung high in the sky like a lantern. There were so many of them, waiting there, in the moonlight, at the foot of Lookout Mountain. Laura was thirsty. Sometimes living people burned steadily in her mind like candles, and sometimes they flamed like torches. It made them easy to avoid, and it made them easy on occasion to find. Shadow had burned so strangely, with his own light up on that tree. She had chided him once when they had walked and held hands for not being alive. She had hoped then to see a spark of raw emotion, to have seen anything. She remembered walking beside him, wishing that he could understand what she was trying to say. But dying on the tree, Shadow had been utterly alive. She had watched him as the life had faded, and he had been focused and real, and he had asked her to stay with him, to stay the whole night. He had forgiven her. Perhaps he had forgiven her. It didn't matter. He had changed. That was all she knew. Shadow had told her to go to the farmhouse, that they would give her water to drink there. There were no lights burning in the farm building, and she could feel nobody at home. But he had told her that they would care for her. She pushed against the door of the farmhouse, and it opened, rusty hinges protesting the whole while. Something moved in her left lung, something that pushed and squirmed and made her cough. She found herself in a narrow hallway, her way almost blocked by a tall and dusty piano. The inside of the building smelled of old damp. She squeezed past the piano, pushed open a door, and found herself in a dilapidated drawing room filled with ramshackle furniture. An oil lamp burned on the mantelpiece. There was a coal fire burning in the fireplace beneath it, although she had neither seen nor smelled smoke outside the house. The coal fire did nothing to lift the chill she felt in that room, although Laura was willing to concede that might not be the fault of the room. Death hurt Laura, although the hurt consisted mostly of things that were not there. A parching thirst that drained every cell of her, an absence of heat in her bones that was absolute. Sometimes she would catch herself wondering whether the crisp and crackling flames of a pyre would warm her, or the soft brown blanket of the earth, whether the cold sea would quench her thirst.
The room, she realized, was not empty. Three women sat on an elderly couch, as if they had come as a matched set in some peculiar artistic exhibition. The couch was upholstered in threadbare velvet, a faded brown that might once, 100 years ago, have been a bright canary yellow. They followed her with their eyes as she entered the room, and they said nothing. Laura had not known they would be there. Something wriggled and fell in her nasal cavity. Laura fumbled in her sleeve for a tissue, and she blew her nose into it. She crumpled the tissue and flung it and its contents onto the coals of the fire, watched it crumple and blacken and become orange lace. She watched the maggots shrivel and brown and burn. This done, she turned back to the women on the couch. They had not moved since she had entered, not a muscle, not a hair. They stared at her.
"Hello? Is this your farm?" she asked.
The largest of the women nodded. Her hands were very red, and her expression was impassive.
"Shadow. That's the guy hanging on the tree. He's my husband. He said I should tell you that he wants you to give me water."
Something large shifted in her bowels. It squirmed and then was still. The smallest woman clambered off the couch. Her feet had not previously reached the floor. She scurried from the room. Laura could hear doors opening and closing through the farmhouse. Then, from outside, she could hear a series of loud creaks. Each was followed by a splash of water. Soon enough, the small woman returned. She was carrying a brown earthenware jug of water. She put it down carefully on the table and retreated to the couch. She pulled herself up with a wriggle and a shiver, and was seated beside her sisters once again.
"Thank you."
Laura walked over to the table, looked around for a cup or a glass, but there was nothing like that to be seen. She picked up the jug. It was heavier than it looked. The water in it was perfectly clear. She raised the jug to her lips and began to drink. The water was colder than she had ever imagined liquid water could be. It froze her tongue and her teeth and her gullet. Still she drank, unable to stop, feeling the water freezing its way into her stomach, her bowels, her heart, her veins. The water flowed into her. It was like liquid ice. She realized that the jug was empty, and, surprised, she put it down on the table. The women were observing her dispassionately. Since her death, Laura had not thought in metaphors. Things were or they were not. But now, as she looked at the women on the sofa, she found herself thinking of juries, of scientists observing a laboratory animal. She shook, suddenly and convulsively. She reached out a hand to the table to steady herself, but the table was slipping and lurching, and it almost avoided her grasp. As she put her hand on the table, she began to vomit. She brought up bile and formalin, centipedes and maggots. And then she felt herself starting to void and to piss. Stuff was being pushed violently, wetly, from her body. She would have screamed if she could. But then the dusty floorboards came up to meet her so fast and so hard that, had she been breathing, they would have knocked the breath from her body. Time rushed over her and into her, swirling like a dust devil. 1,000 memories began to play at once. She was lost in a department store the week before Christmas, and her father was nowhere to be seen. And now she was sitting in the bar at Chi-Chi's, ordering a strawberry daiquiri and checking out her blind date, the big, grave man-child, and wondering how he kissed. And she was in the car as, sickeningly, it rolled and jolted, and Robbie was screaming at her until the metal post finally stopped the car, but not its contents, from moving. The water of time, which comes from the spring of fate, Urd's well, is not the water of life. Not quite. It feeds the roots of the world tree, though. And there is no other water like it. When Laura woke in the empty farmhouse room, she was shivering, and her breath actually steamed in the morning air. There was a scrape on the back of her hand, and a wet smear on the scrape, the vivid red of fresh blood. And she knew where she had to go. She had drunk from the water of time, which comes from the spring of fate. She could see the mountain in her mind. She licked the blood from the back of her hand, marveling at the film of saliva. And she began to walk.
This ends Disc 15. American Gods, Disc 16.
It was a wet March day, and it was unseasonably cold, and the storms of the previous few days had lashed their way across the southern states, which meant that there were very few real tourists at Rock City on Lookout Mountain. The Christmas lights had been taken down. The summer visitors were yet to start coming. Still, there were people there. There was even a tour bus that drew up that morning, releasing a dozen men and women with perfect tans and gleaming, reassuring smiles. They looked like news anchors, and one could almost imagine there was a phosphor dot quality to them. They seemed to blur gently as they moved. A black Humvee was parked in the front lot of Rock City. The TV people walked intently through Rock City, stationing themselves near the balancing rock, where they talked to each other in pleasant, reasonable voices. They were not the only people in this wave of visitors. If you had walked the paths of Rock City that day, you might have noticed people who looked like movie stars, and people who looked like aliens, and a number of people who looked most of all like the idea of a person and nothing like the reality. You might have seen them, but most likely you would never have noticed them at all. They came to Rock City in long limousines and in small sports cars and in oversized SUVs. Many of them wore the sunglasses of those who habitually wear sunglasses indoors and out and do not willingly or comfortably remove them. There were suntans and suits and shades and smiles and scowls. They came in all sizes and shapes, all ages and styles. All they had in common was a look, a very specific look. It said, "You know me," or perhaps, "You ought to know me." An instant familiarity that was also a distance, a look, or an attitude, the confidence that the world existed for them and that it welcomed them and that they were adored. The fat kid moved among them with the shuffling walk of one who, despite having no social skills, has still become successful beyond his dreams. His black coat flapped in the wind. Something that stood beside the soft drink stand in Mother Goose Court coughed to attract his attention. It was massive, and scalpel blades jutted from its face and its fingers. Its face was cancerous.
"It would be a mighty battle,"
it told him in a glutinous voice.
"It's not going to be a battle," said the fat kid. "All we're facing here is a fucking paradigm shift. It's a shakedown. Modalities like battle are so fucking Lao Tzu."
The cancerous thing blinked at him.
"Waiting,"
is all it said in reply.
"Whatever," said the fat kid. Then, "I'm looking for Mr. World. You seen him?"
The thing scratched itself with a scalpel blade, a tumorous lower lip pushed out in concentration. Then it nodded.
"Over there," it said.
The fat kid walked away, without a thank you, in the direction indicated. The cancerous thing waited, saying nothing, until the kid was out of sight.
"It will be a battle,"
said the cancerous thing to a woman whose face was smudged with phosphor dots. She nodded and leaned closer to it. "So how does that make you feel?" she asked, in a sympathetic voice. It blinked, and then it began to tell her. Town's Ford Explorer had a global positioning system, a little screen that listened to the satellites and showed the car its location, but he still got lost once he got south of Blacksburg and onto the country roads. The roads he drove seemed to bear little relationship to the tangle of lines on the map on the screen. Eventually, he stopped the car in a country lane, wound down the window, and asked a fat white woman being pulled by a wolfhound on its early morning walk for directions to Ash Tree Farm. She nodded and pointed and said something to him. He couldn't understand what she had said, but he said thanks a million and wound up the window and drove off in the general direction she had indicated. He kept going for